Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're going to do the second part of our conversation with Dr. Nick Turan. He's a Seattle-based nuclear engineer. Nick and I will continue discussing the pros and cons of nuclear-generated electricity and how it can fit into a fossil-free, low-carbon future. So let's pick it up. We're in a race in a lot of regards. So, you know, between how much fossil fuel pollution we're going to put in the atmosphere and how much time and so on. So let's talk about time for a second. And I'm sort of jumping ahead of myself, but it seems appropriate. So let's say you and I decide we're going to build a nuclear power plant and we're going to start today. Mm-hmm. When would we start seeing electricity come out of that plant here in the United States?
Well, it depends on many things. So if we were politically unencumbered, we would go to South Korea and we would say, hey, South Koreans, you guys have been pounding out these highly optimized reactors in 4 to 5 years. Can you come and build one of those exact designs at this particular site? And you would have it up and running in 4 to 5 years, you know, bringing in the Koreans to help do the project management, to do the procurement of the equipment and so on. You could do it in, roughly 4 to 5 years, get maybe 1 or 2 gigawatt years per year of electricity. Now, that's not how it's going to happen because of various, that's sort of a beautiful path, because when South Korea first learned nuclear, the United States taught them how to do it. There was a company that was going under, Combustion Engineering, who sold them their full design. The Combustion Engineering engineers went and taught them how to construct it and build it. And then the South Koreans sort of perfected it. And so if they could bring that knowledge back, because we've kind of forgotten how to successfully deliver a nuclear project in the United States. And this is unfortunate. It's just because, you know, there's sort of been a 30-year lull of not having those supply chains, and it takes time to build that capability back up. So we have these two big reactors in Georgia at Plant Vogtle that have somewhat boondoggled. They're good plants, but there have been all sorts of legal, contractual problems, regulatory changes in the middle of construction that have caused it to be, you know, a 15-year project that's way over budget. And so that's obviously not something that can continue. On the other hand, there's been a lot of learning. So, you know, if we were to build the next one just like that, it's the serialization is how you get effective at it. And that's what the South Koreans did. That's what Japan did in the 90s. And that's what China has done. China can build them very effectively right now. But in the West, we've all sort of forgotten how to do it. And they've been boondoggling. And so, I mean, the best thing to do, as I said, would be to bring in the people who are currently delivering them on time, on budget, and have them basically lead the project until we can relearn how to do it. But the political challenges of bringing in other companies from other countries and paying them, you know, there's political challenges.
Yep. Well, it's so we're talking about the Koreans. That would just be construction time. It says, okay, here's your check. Go to work. 5 years later, we're producing electricity. So what are the regulatory barriers in the United States to actually doing that?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has certified several designs. They've taken a look at the design and they said, okay, if you build, it took them years to certify the design. They analyzed it and then they say, okay, this design has our stamp of approval. So if you choose that design and build it to those specifications, you're good to go. We'll come in and we'll check it and make sure that you did it to specifications, but no additional pre-work needed. And so if you were to choose one of those designs, there's about 12 of them that have design certifications, some of which can be produced by people around the world, then that would be the way to go. and that's one of the challenges of these the newer advanced reactors that don't have design certifications. You have to go through the certification process, which can take many years. So again, it just depends. So for decarbonizing rapidly now, I mean, 80% of the world is powered by high carbon sources. And so we need, you know, 10 times more wind, 10 times more solar, 10 times more hydro, geothermal, and 10 times more nuclear. We need everything that's low carbon. And so we should be building basically pre-certified designs all over the place right now to replace the fossil generators and the biofuel generators, and then bring in the advanced designs, as I said earlier. But yeah, so I would say start with a pre-certified design too, because of the urgency of climate change.
Okay, forgive me here, but back to my question. Why aren't we doing that?
The why are the so we the one that we're building in Georgia, the two plants that we're building boondoggled so bad and are so were such a problem that the other utilities are just like, no thanks. Like, we cannot take on that type of risk. We aren't big enough to absorb that kind of risk. And so we're gonna build wind and solar, which are heavily subsidized, production tax credits and so on. And we're going to and they're also extremely popular. I mean, like 80-90% approvals, and we're going to build natural gas plants to back them up. And that's what we're doing. And it's like popularity and it's economics. And that's half good. I mean, wind and solar are truly zero carbon sources, but this backup is a very high carbon source. And yeah, there's progress in batteries, but the amount of batteries you need to replace like a gas turbine is astronomical and starts having environmental disasters of its own. So it'd be much better if you could build wind and solar with nuclear, which are all zero carbon and can ramp up and down anyway. So the reason is economics,
Yeah, it
stated
seems like maybe
quickly.
there's a tipping point out there somewhere, somewhere in the vague future where the combination of economics and popular opinion and utilities' willingness to take on the risk, we reach that point and then we'll start installing new nuclear capability. But we'll just have to see on that one, I guess.
Yeah.
So you made reference to other kinds of nuclear energy generation, stuff that's not certified yet. And my guess is you're talking at least in part small modular reactors. Would that be an area you're talking about?
That is one. Although just last week, the NRC certified the first small modular reactor in the United States, the NuScale design. So it now is among that list of 13 or so that are pre-certified. So like that plant, you can the major regulatory risks are de-risked. So that's one major progress. There are several other small modular reactor designs being developed and going through licensing right now. GE has one. That's the first one's probably going to be in Canada. And there's some others that are still, they're basically scaled down versions of the typical water-cooled reactor. And then there's a whole other class of reactors. Some are big, some are small, that are non-water cooled, either small or medium or large size reactors. And those are going through kind of early talks with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but they haven't, none of those are certified at the point.
So, if you had a magic wand, what would you be wanting the United States to be doing right now in terms of adding nuclear power? And then, use your magic wand.
Well, my magic wand involves a somewhat crazy sounding idea, which is but in short, it's build a bunch of already certified reactors right now. So ABWR is one particular type of, it's called a Gen 3 plus reactor that we know how to build, and they're great, and we should be building them like crazy. And serialize them, use the same people to do the supply chain and just have one after the other after the other. And then use, as that's happening, keep doing the certifications of the advanced reactors to get, they can do things like high temperature steam, they can do passive cooling, they can they they're in they can run on average crustal granite, so they are infinitely renewable. I mean, they can power the world for 4 billion years. And so like, so how would you serialize? There's this crazy story and a true story that happened in the 70s where a company, there was a partnership between Newport News Shipyard and Westinghouse, and they built a facility in Jacksonville, Florida, that was basically a shipyard that would build nuclear plants, big nuclear plants on huge floating platforms in a serial. It was like a factory, like a gigafactory of large pressurized water reactors. So they could build, they'd scale, they made it to build four identical plants per year. And, the same construction crew would just build it right there on site and then like float it off to its site. And they
Wow.
could, they were, the first one was actually planned to be operated offshore, off the New Jersey shore. It was called the Atlantic the Atlantic Generating Station. But you could also, if you didn't want it to be floating, you could just float it to site and then build around it to have it sort of embedded in the land. But they bought and installed the world's biggest gantry crane. They had 1,000 people working on it. It was a huge project, and they got a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build the first 8. So they got a construction license, which is so they really took it super far. There was a huge amount of work on it, and that idea it then ramped down because at the time electricity demand, which was expected to be going up, flattened out, and so their customers dried up, and so they couldn't make any sales, and they eventually had to go away. But I mean, if you wanted to decarbonize the world rapidly, then that kind of setup, a shipyard-based construction facility of large nuclear plants or small ones, but large, you get economies of scale and economies of mass production, is probably the most interesting and potentially effective way to like really pound out a bunch of zero carbon energy in the timescales that we're looking. So
Yeah,
that's my real magic wand.
well, no, it's an energizing concept, and you can point to some reality in the past that says, yeah, we could do this. So you mentioned the Navy. I think Newport News, I think it doesn't matter where. So we know that aircraft carriers and submarines have been powered by nuclear reactors for a long time. So how are those reactors different from the kind of stuff we're talking about?
They're very similar, honestly. I mean, in fact, the commercial nuclear industry came out of the submarine reactors. I mean,
Really?
Admiral Rickover, they were invented by Alvin Weinberg, the pressurized water reactor. It was designed for submarines because it's simple, it's compact, and it's reliable, which is what you need in a submarine. And so the first commercial nuclear plant was literally a scaled up submarine reactor at shipping port. I mean, it's almost the exact same design. All the components are the same. The fuel is, well, a little bit different, but the overall system is very, very similar. They do use highly enriched uranium in those cores, so they can have a little tiny core that makes a lot of power for 30 years, whereas the commercial stations use not weapons grade uranium. They use 5% enriched instead of 9. But besides that, they're like basically the same concept.
Okay, so given that, what's the safety record of those reactors been, those Navy reactors?
It's been fantastic. As far as anyone's aware, there haven't been any serious nuclear accidents or any nuclear accidents at all in the submarines or aircraft carriers. I'm sure there have been various incidents and so on, but there's no like big radiological accident that has happened. We did lose, the US Navy has lost 2 submarines, the Scorpion and the Thresher, both of which were unrelated to the nuclear power station. But so those and then and no one's detected any radiation leaking from the crashes from where those are at the bottom of the ocean. So the safety record is basically perfect for the US Navy. They run a pretty good operation.
Well, that's an impressive fact, given how long they've been using those guys and how much use they've gotten out of them. So, a little bit of a change of gears here. The European Union has recently classified nuclear energy as green energy. So, what's going on there? Why would they do that?
Yeah, I've been following this for quite a while, somewhat closely, and it's very exciting that they did do that. I mean, they got together a UN panel of scientists and they said, okay, let's look at all the different elements. And they have this thing called a do no harm or do no significant harm criteria. And they looked at all the different energy sources and did sort of dispassionate analysis. And they looked at all the literature and did their own synthesis. And sure enough, they came up with the fact that nuclear plants are indeed extremely low carbon, extremely safe. They have low impacts on land. They don't need that much raw materials. And so they met all the criteria. Like if you look at it as a scientist, it's clear that they meet the green energy criteria. And so the scientists said exactly that. And of course, there was a lot of debate because there are people in Europe, in particular in Germany, who are basically, it's like part of the national identity to be anti-nuclear. It's a huge, I didn't know this until recently, but more than like 40% of Greenpeace donations come from Germany, like worldwide. Super interesting. And so there is a, and Germany is a very powerful member of the European Union. Austria is also very anti-nuclear in general. And so they pushed back. And so they had to make a deal, basically, and the deal, which is kind of obnoxious, they had to classify natural gas as green because Germany is so into natural gas. By the way, they've spent 10 billion euros in the first 2 months. They've bought 10 billion euros of natural gas from Russia in the first 2 months after Russia invaded the Ukraine. So like they're just totally tied to natural gas, and they're bankrolling Russia due to their addiction to natural gas. But anyway, so like the deal was, okay, we'll make nuclear, which is clearly and scientifically green. We'll also classify natural gas, which is clearly not. I mean, it's extremely high carbon. Yeah, it's a little bit better than coal on the particulates, but the carbon emissions are astronomical. And so like somehow that was the deal. And we're sort of like, okay, we'll take it. I'm glad nuclear's in, but like how obnoxious that this fossil fuel natural gas is also in. What a disaster.
Yeah, so that gives the detractor something to point to. It says, oh, yeah, sure, nuclear is green,
Exactly.
just like natural gas is green. So, as you say, unfortunate. So, speaking of Germany, now I know that Germany has been taking nuclear power plants offline. And so, what if it's, so that means reduced electricity production. And so, how are they making up that gap?
They're buying billions of dollars of natural gas from Russia.
Okay,
I mean,
so.
that's it. And they're, oh, and they're turning on their old coal plants. They're turning back on retired coal plants. They have a lot of brown, really horrible coal, the worst and least healthy coal. And they're digging up villages and turning coal back on rather than reversing. I mean, they just turned off three nuclear plants a couple months ago. They have three left, and they're planning on turning those off. And at this point, it's becoming so ridiculous that even some of the German higher ups have started saying, like, okay, maybe we'll consider leaving those nuclear plants on. But it's so unpopular in Germany that there's like a huge uproar, and the people in charge are like just religiously anti-nuclear, against all rationale, in my opinion. So it is kind of looking like they might extend the last three a little bit at this point. It's not a sure thing, but it'd be shocking if they didn't, honestly. But yeah, they're turning their coal plants on, and they're paying Russia billions of dollars per month for gas.
Yep, so politics takes us to some strange places. So I guess I should say politics and ideology. And I do see some irony in the fact that right across the border in France, they pull something like 70% of their or their electrical energy from nuclear. Is that pretty close?
Yeah, that's about right. They in the after the Suez crisis, they decided as a nation that they didn't want to be dependent on any other country for their energy. So they picked a design, and they built 50 some of them in 15 years. They decarbonized their entire grid in 15 years, and now they're largely nuclear powered for their electricity. It's like 70%.
Yep. Well, it's great to have that track record to point to. One of the things I wanted to ask you about waste, and I forgot to ask you, and I want to double back to that for a second. I've heard in the media reports that there are proposals for reactors that can use existing waste for fuel. Is that something that's true?
Yes, that is true. There is a type of reactor, or a class of reactors, called a breeder reactor, which was first demonstrated in 1952 out in Idaho, which can basically take what comes out of a current generation light water reactor and get a lot more energy out of it. We only get about 1% of the total nuclear energy out of the uranium that we mine,
Wow.
and there are reactors that can get, well, theoretically 100%, but practically it's like 90% because of process losses. You basically have to recycle. So you take the spent fuel that comes out of a reactor, and then you put it in a facility where you can melt it down and run chemical reactions on it to separate out the atoms that have split, which are called fission products. So they're kind of like half the size of uranium. Those are true waste. And then you have the other material, which is the rest of the uranium, that you can then put in special reactors and get the energy out of it.
Well, are there people that are building or proposing to build those kind of reactors right now?
Yes. So every there are most countries, many big nuclear powered countries have run breeder reactor programs throughout through history, and some have built breeder type reactors. There are several operating. There's one in China, one in India, a couple in Russia. So there are these reactors exist and are out there. And then there are a couple companies that are working on breeder type reactors in this advanced reactor category. So one, I mean, in Seattle, TerraPower is working on a reactor that is intended to eventually become a breeder reactor. And their twist is it's a breeder reactor that doesn't need reprocessing. So it's kind of you've just deeply burn the fuel in a once through cycle and then have it be waste. And that you get about 30% of the energy out, which is a lot more than 1%. And so, you know, it's not 90%, but still quite good. And then there's other companies. There's one called Terrestrial that's making a fluid fuel breeder reactor. And that those are pretty interesting as well. TerraPower has another project that's a fluid fuel breeder reactor. Those are molten salt design. So yeah, there's others. There's a great map that someone put together that shows like 50 different nuclear startup companies in the United States working on sort of interesting designs. But yeah, the major progress is happening. I mean, there's plenty of progress in some of these companies for sure. I should mention that China has built a very interesting molten salt reactor that just got authorization yesterday to become critical. So they're going to turn it on in the next, I don't know, couple weeks or a month or so. And that's a really exciting breeder reactor that we had in the United States back in 1969, and nothing like that has operated since then. So they're sort of picking back up that particular development trajectory. So yeah, and there's pros and cons. Like, yes, recycling waste sounds great, and it does really reduce the amount of waste. There are complications, and like, I mean, when we had a breeder program in the United States, it was called the Clinch River Breeder Reactor Project, which was shut down by Jimmy Carter and became hugely politically unpopular because of concerns with like, well, if you're recycling the waste, you're extracting some purified plutonium, and somebody could steal that and make a weapon. And so there's all this concern about proliferation. Reprocessing radioactive material is expensive. So right now, because nuclear is pretty expensive already, adding in another expensive recycling step isn't going to help. And also there's a huge amount of uranium in the world. So since we're only making 5% of the world's power, it's not urgent to go to reprocessing. Whereas if we were making 50% of the world's power, like, okay, you need breeder reactors at that point. But until, like, my personal opinion is like we should get our feet under us with economical, more standard reactors first, and as those scale up, transition over to the breeder reactors with reprocessing.
Yeah, so one of the things that occurs to me just listening to you talking about countries, Finland, Russia, India, China, and so we really have abrogated leadership in the world on nuclear. Is
Oh,
that a
yeah.
fair thing to say?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we still operate the most commercial plants out of anyone, but China's going to surpass us pretty soon here. But in terms of like who's running the advanced reactors, yeah, we shut them all down. We were amazing. We had this incredible set of reactors that we were working on, and we basically canceled or shut them all down. And now the only ones running advanced or, you know, sort of experimental prototype reactors are the countries, not the United States. And so all the major developments are happening outside the United States right now. That's not to say, I mean, the United States is now putting significant funding into advanced reactors. There's something called the Advanced Reactor Development Program, where there's a big cost share with some of the big, there's a gas cooled reactor called the X Energy. And then TerraPower mentioned earlier, there's a lot of cost share happening with the US government. So it's not that the US is ignoring them, but at the moment, all the like interesting exotic reactors that are operating are outside the States. And so that's where the real hands-on experience is getting.
Yep. Let's change tack here again for just a second. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 looks like it's probably going to become law. So any thoughts or is any what's in there that might impact the nuclear industry here in the United States, if anything?
Yeah, there's actually it's there's it's a, we're all there's a lot of excitement about that coming through. So yeah, and there is quite a bit about nuclear in that act, which we're really excited to see. I mean, it really acknowledges it helps all the low carbon energy sources, wind, solar, hydro, geothermal, and nuclear. So we're pretty excited that like they were like, well, nuclear's low carbon, so let's help it. And so a couple things in there. One is that all the existing plants get a basically like a production tax credit type. So for it's like 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour or something like that. So that'll help all the economics of all the existing plants. And that's to acknowledge the fact that we value low carbon energy. It's not a carbon tax, but it's so anyway, so that's going to help the existing fleet, which is very important. And then there is a there's an investment, $700 million, I believe, to pick up production of a type of nuclear fuel called HALEU. It's enriched. It's and that's to support the advanced reactor development community. Most of those reactors need enrichment. That's not what the submarine reactors use, but it's higher than what a traditional reactor uses. And that's usually just to kind of get them. They're sometimes smaller and so on. So, and there's no supply of that outside of Russia. And so it's going to help us build up that supply. So we're not dependent on Russia for that type of material. And there's a couple other things in there for nuclear. There's an investment tax credit for advanced nuclear. So for small modular reactors and these non-water cooled reactors, if you're doing R&D on them, you can get a major tax credit up to 50% to support development of those reactors. So those are major benefits to the nuclear industry that are in.
Yeah, well, so that kind of makes a statement of its own because, I mean, this is a let's call it a left of center bill. And so it says something about the center of gravity there in the left of center part about nuclear power. So interesting that it's been lumped together with all those other.
And I credit, I mean, there's a lot of really progressive people in nuclear who are now getting into think tanks. There's something called the Good Energy Collective, which is a bunch of PhD nuclear scientist women who have all gotten together. They're all super progressive, and they put together a think tank to be that voice, the voice of the left who supports nuclear because they follow the science. And so I think the creation of some of those things, which are unheard of before, has really helped. I mean, the Assistant Secretary of Energy for Nuclear, Katie Huff, is an old friend of mine, and is well, I mean, she fits perfectly into the Biden administration, and she's extremely smart. She's a professor of nuclear engineering, and she's now basically running the part of the Department of Energy that does nuclear stuff. And so she's in there helping to push policy, and it's totally aligned with the values on the left. And so anyway, it's kind of new and interesting, and it seems to be making good progress.
Yeah, so I spend a fair amount of my psychic time worried about the future, and it's difficult for me to be cheerful as I look into the future. But one of the things I'm seeing from our conversation today is that nuclear really can be a part of getting us to that low carbon future, and that there's a lot of potential, a lot of possibility there, and a lot of other countries are seeing that. And the fact that let's call them once again left of center folks are starting to say, yeah, this is a good path forward. That's a cause for optimism. So we are close to the end here. So what I would like to do is finish up where we started, and that is just give us a rundown on why we should have nuclear power in our energy future.
Okay, we should have nuclear power in our energy future because it is a low carbon 24/7 energy source that uses a tiny amount of land and a tiny amount of raw materials and perfectly complements the progress we're seeing with low carbon wind and solar in a way that we can do all the low carbon energies symbiotically. So at night and when it's calm, the nuclear plants can be running the base load and ramping up and down as necessary to support wind and solar. The waste problem is handled responsibly. We know the appropriate long-term solutions. We just have to get the politics set up so that we can actually deliver on the repository, as was done in Finland. This compared to combustion energy sources, the safety of nuclear is second to none. It's as safe as wind and solar, surprising most people. But when you actually pull up the numbers and study it without your biases, you'll see that indeed it's true. And so, and decarbonizing is serious. I mean, we can't fight decarbonization with one hand tied behind our back. Like, why would we set aside our our most successful decarbonization technology when we're facing such a challenge. I mean, we're still increasing the amount of fossil fuel the world sees. And so we really need to get actually serious about decarbonizing. And to do so, we need all the low carbon energy. And because of nuclear's niche, again, 24/7 tiny footprint, it's perfect to fit into the mix. And so we really should be supporting it and accepting building more of it.
So that's a terrific summary, Nick. I really appreciate it. Also, really appreciate the time you spent with us. I just want to acknowledge the energy and intelligence and enthusiasm you're bringing to your work, and in a challenging environment, and one which it's hard to see the needle ever moving because of any of our efforts. So, best wishes going forward, and thanks again so much for joining us today on Climate Talk.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks so much to Dr. Turin for sharing his expertise in nuclear energy with us. It's a simple fact that it's hard for me, and probably for you as a layperson, to understand in detail the ins and outs of nuclear energy. That means we must listen to people who do understand what's going on, both from a theoretical and a practical perspective. Nick, I believe, is such a person. This doesn't mean that we are off the hook for working at understanding the science and the data and for making judgments between competing calls for how we get to a clean energy economy. Most of all, considering the stakes for our species in getting to a clean energy economy, we are called on to rely on more than just our ideological point of view in deciding what we support and what we don't. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all the other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.